Colonel Corbin, Reel 2.
Well, as I was saying, it was very, very cold on top of the mountains, or the hills rather, of Marla Pass, and we had only our summer uniform, and after a very sweaty and hot advance and climb, it was a bit of a contrast, and we hadn't had any food for a long time, but my CO mustered all the drivers of the three-ton lorries, who were Cape coloured drivers from South Africa, and they very nobly carried up all the food and water, which we badly needed, during the course of the night. So everybody got a square meal and replenished their water bottles. I may say that during the night, or rather early on after we'd captured the right breast, there was an enormous explosion in the Marder Pass itself, which was obviously the blowing up of the road. And during the night, there were streams of light coming towards Marder Pass on the Italian side. So I must say I was a bit nervous, thinking that these might be reinforcements for a counterattack. But by that time, I was able to speak to my CO on the artillery landline telephone, and he organized a lot of lorries to drive in darkness down towards Jujiga again and then come back with their lights blazing to look as if we were being reinforced, all a big bluff. And of course the Italians weren't reinforcing at all, they were just hoping to get away as quickly as they could. I'm sorry to say that we had a lot of casualties altogether. I think it was something like 32 British officers, one of whom shouldn't have been there at all. It was the second in command of the battalion, who ought to have been left behind to replace the CO if he was killed, but he'd irrationally joined in the attack because he was a very, very good officer. And he was killed in the counterattack on my two platoons on Camel Hill, as was one of the platoon commanders and quite a lot of the excellent soldiers. And, well, that's about it, because after that, the 2nd Battalion or the 3rd Battalion in Nigeria went through when the Marder Pass had been repaired and carried on the battle, which lasted for about 50 miles, because there were a lot of very hilly country on the way to Harar. And, well, that was really my main battle.
How did your Nigerian troops take to having such heavy casualties?
Well, they're very philosophical about death. I mean, they aren't quite as hysterical as I think we have become in this country. And, you know, death, well, it happens. But as I say, it was the first experience of anything like warfare. I had tremendous admiration for them. No, they took it in very good way, really. I mean, they said, well, that's happened, and we get on with it.
What did they think they were fighting for? What was their motivation for fighting? Was it purely mercenary or what?
No, I think they generally respected the British. Although I know it's very unpopular to say these things, if they had good officers or some good NCOs, British officers and NCOs, they would do anything for you. I mean, they regarded their company commander and platoon commanders as their sort of gods and their family. I mean, that'd be terribly unpopular to say. But they really did, and they were little country bumpkins in the in that way. But I mean, they were well looked after. We always took care; they were properly fed and watered. And if they had any problems at home, well, we did our best to sort those out. And I think they'd never experienced such care and consideration as they got from the British officers and NCOs.
What kind of home problems were you having to sort out?
Well, there weren't very many, because, I mean, there wasn't any means of communicating quickly with Nigeria itself. But when somebody was killed, obviously you had to find out whether his wife or family, whether they were going to be well looked after financially and all that sort of thing. And the soldiers who survived realized that we were doing things to look after them. Incidentally, we had a malam, which was a civilian religious person who accompanied each company. And he used to provide the sort of, I don't know how to put it quite, the sort of stimulus to help them to understand what was going on and to help them in their family problems. Because he was a Nigerian, and a sort of link between them, the Nigerian soldiers, and the Europeans. But I mean, the Europeans that had been with the battalion for a long time, or quite a long time, knew the soldiers very well. I mean, I knew mine intimately, and I knew if they had any problems. But on the whole, they didn't have problems, because the situation in Nigeria was entirely different. They didn't have such a government-oriented or social security orientated outlook on things. Basically, they looked after themselves in the best way they could, and they looked after their families. And I think in the villages too, if a man was killed, the rest of the villages would probably rally around the widow and her children and try and help them. And of course, the British, not the governor, but the people who looked after each province, the white,
the district officer.
District officer, that's right. Sorry, the district officer would also know what was going on. And but as I say, the trouble really was communications were very difficult, because although we had a postal service, it took a long time to get round the Cape of Cape Horn. So, I mean, probably nobody knew of the death of their husbands or brothers or whatever for quite a long time afterwards.
Were most of your soldiers married men or unmarried men?
I can't really remember that. I think we had quite a good mixture, because they did marry fairly young. I would say about 40% married and 50% unmarried.
And
that's an absolute guess, I have to say.
If somebody was killed, would the wife or parents get money from the army?
I'm afraid I can't remember that. I don't know whether they had a war pension scheme.
Now, can we jump ahead to 1945, to Belsen, and can you tell me how you got your job in connection with that concentration camp, please?
Well, I was commanding the 4th Battalion of the Wiltshire Regiment at the end of the war, and when the war ended on the 8th of May, we were actually somewhere near Bremen, because we just helped to capture Bremen. And some weeks later, the army was being sort of reoriented, and battalions were being found more permanent locations in which to live for the next few months while the rundown took place. And the 4th Wiltshires were sent to the barracks in Bergen-Belsen. And I should point out here that the concentration camp was about 3 miles away from the most beautiful barracks you can imagine, which were, which I think took a whole division of German troops when it was originally built. And we were occupying a part of that, a very small part of that, and the rest of it was occupied by something like 25,000 Jewish refugees and other refugees from the concentration camps from all over Germany. And I think they were nearly all people who wanted to go to Israel. So really my battalion was posted as a permanent garrison to provide security in the Bergen-Belsen, in the proper barracks part. The concentration camp, as I say, about 3 miles away, that had been burnt to the ground a bit earlier on by flamethrowers, including those from my battalion. So there wasn't anything left in the way of structures except the permanent buildings occupied by the guards. And rather a dirty mess where the huts had been, and of course enormous mounds where literally thousands of people had died and been buried within the campsite. And I always remember an enormous pile of shoes, male and female, which had been accumulated, I suppose, while they were being cremated, while the people were being cremated, but they obviously had to discard their shoes. But as I say, our purpose was mainly to provide security in the camp and in the neighbouring area, because it was felt that maybe some of these refugees would want to take vengeance on the German population. In fact, we never had any trouble. And the camp of Jewish people was administered entirely by civilian organizations. I think a Jewish organization from America was particularly active there. And then there were a sort of a large contingent of Red Cross people, a small unit of war crimes investigation people, which incidentally had a very well-known actor called Leo Genn on its staff. I don't suppose anybody's heard of him now, because he was getting on in years even then. The UNRRA, the United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Association. And they were not a very outstanding lot. I mean, I think most of them were people who'd managed to evade call-up in their various countries for the war, and were now sort of cashing in on the peacetime end of it, and not averse to dealing in the black market. But perhaps I'm being unkind. Those were the main people, and of course we all got to know each other very well, because there was a fairly small contingent of Westerners, including all those running the camp. And I think that as the Jews were turned over and shipped out to via Italy, I think it was, to go to Israel, more Jews arrived from other parts of Germany and settled in. The thing that sticks in my memory at that time is that the winter was a very, very cold one, as it often is in Germany. And of course, there was very little fuel in the way of coal, because all the mines had been disrupted. And so there was a very limited supply of electricity. But the Jews, with their ingenuity, had fitted up bare wires in their various barrack rooms, which they were really barrack rooms, and very dangerous bare wires leading from plugs in order to spread a bit of heat in the room. I don't know how it worked, because I'm not at all technical. But it was a pretty alarming situation. But anyway, that was somebody else's problem, not mine. We remained there for about, until my battalion disbanded, which was at the end of 1946, which was a very difficult time, with people going off, and rather key people going off civilian life, and finally being posted to a different battalion. One would see them off and say, oh, well, you're going to the King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry. And on the way, they'd have their destination changed and they'd be going somewhere else. So there was a lot of administrative problems in those days.
Why do you think that the victims of the concentration camps did not attempt to take any kind of revenge against Germans?
Well, Belsen is rather it's not a country area, and although there was a town called, well, Celle was the town nearby, it was quite a long way off, and most of the inmates who I saw certainly were in no fit state to do anything very much in that respect, and I think, you know, they were so happy to be released. And they used to go down, to those who could get about still, go down to Celle in their awful striped pyjamas, which were so degrading. And you'd see them wandering about in the town. And, of course, they lived in the hospital, a lot of them in their pyjamas. Although, on the whole, they were given new clothes as soon as they could be. But I think, on the whole, they were... As I say, it's just thankful to be released. And anybody near at hand, well, they couldn't actually pinpoint him and say, oh, well, he did it. They knew that the guards, who I may say some of the worst ones, I'm told, were Poles. Polish people enlisted and given extra rations in order to be guards. And they were some of the most brutal, I gather. We also had to provide a guard for the people who had been guard, Kramer and Irma Gracer, who was the most notorious couple of guards there. And they were locked up in Celle, and my company, whose commander was Major Robbins in those days, he was the company commander who was responsible for their guarding.
Did you see much of these two individuals? Did you personally see much of these two individuals you've mentioned?
I did see them, yes. I used to go down. I used to go down to the prison occasionally to see if everything was all right. I'm not trying to make excuses because there weren't any, but. There were tremendous problems at the end of the war for feeding people in Belsen camp because the railway lines had been completely disrupted. And although I'm sure the guards lived like fighting cocks, enough food to feed however many prisoners they had was quite difficult to come by. But I mean, that is no excuse because they always had been starved to death anyway. During my time there, well, soon after I arrived there, I decided to clean up the site of the camp because there were still a lot of pools of dirty water and a certain amount of rubbish still lying around. So I got 100 prisoners of war from the local prisoner of war camp and made them live nearly on site. And every day they had to tidy up the place until in the end it looked quite normal, and this was when the Jewish organization started planning to put up memorials and so on, and I believe there are quite a number of those things now. I haven't been back, so I don't know.
How were Kramer and Irma Gracer being treated?
Oh, they were treated, what, by the, in prison, you mean? Well, as far as I know, they were treated quite normally. I mean, they weren't starved or beaten or anything like that. But Major Robbins can tell you more about that because he was actually there.
What was the attitude of the troops you had under you to the situation there?
Well, we didn't actually see it when at its worst. We did have the opportunity because my battalion was about 30 miles south of Belsen when it was released, and we were temporarily stopped in a village called Vincent. And the army commander said we could use lorries to go up and look at Belsen, so to know how terrible it was. But I decided I wouldn't personally go because I could believe the horrors, and I didn't particularly want to add to the lot I knew about. But I don't think any of the soldiers went either. But they were pretty they were pretty horrified.
You showed me a couple of photographs. One was of a visit by a Russian army dignitary. What was all that about?
Well, sometime after we got there, I think probably this mass grave of Russian prisoners of war had already been discovered, but I'm not absolutely certain about that. And obviously somebody was in touch with the Russians about this, and they wanted to have either a memorial service or to have somebody representative come and see the place. So a Russian general was due to come, accompanied by the British, I think he was a corps commander, actually, I can't remember his name. And we provided a small guard to receive them, and he went along to see the site where these some 2,000 Russian prisoners of war had been buried. But I don't know whether anything came of that in the end. I expect they did probably put up a memorial, but I can't remember now.
And another photograph you showed me was of a Wiltshire soldier with a couple of Hungarians. Who were the Hungarians?
Well, there was a Hungarian cavalry regiment there. I think they didn't take part in any of the guard duties. I'm not quite sure what they were there for, in fact. But they were allowed to sort of remain unlocked up. They weren't treated as prisoners of war for some reason or another. They lived somewhere nearby, in a camp, or I don't think it was part of the barracks. And some of them, or several of them, came to work in the officers' mess because my soldiers were being demobbed steadily, so they were only too glad to come and work in the officers' mess. And anyway, the Hungarian cavalry regiment was due to go back to Hungary, and a lot of them didn't want to go back because, of course, Hungary was in communist hands then. And these two particular young men, who were very clean and nice and honest, came to me one day and said they didn't want to go back to Hungary, so what should they do? So as Germany was, or had been, and was still heaving with displaced people sort of travelling all over the country to get back to their own countries, I said, well, the best thing you can do is to make yourself scarce and go and join these DPs, displaced persons, and see what happens. Well, I think they must have done that, but I never heard from them again. And I hope they succeeded in finding a new life. The Hungarian regiment had a sort of gymkhana one day, which was slightly embarrassing. They didn't use proper rifles, they made wooden rifles and gave a show, which was quite unexpected. Otherwise, I might have stopped it. Or I might have stopped them taking even wooden rifles. And they gave a display on horseback, which was very good indeed. And amongst other things, they presented me with a cigarette box with their regimental crest on it, which I gave to the Imperial War Museum if they wanted. And they also did a recording of Winston Churchill's opening speech at the House of Commons, when Parliament reassembled for the first time after an election, after the end of the war. And it was a recording of his speech, which was on a very flimsy disc, which I never managed to play because I think it would have fallen apart. Anyway, that's also with the Imperial War Museum now, if they want it.
Did you ever have any conversations with any of the camp victims?
I think probably not, because I think there was a bit of a language barrier for a start. And although I think, I mean, I did have one or two conversations with people who'd come from other parts of Germany, not necessarily concentration camps, but wanted to go to Israel. So had come to the camp to be transited to Israel. I mean, some of them looked quite fit and well, in fact. So I think maybe they weren't all concentration camp victims. But the ones I saw when we finally got to Belsen after the end of the war, I did see some in the hospital, because that was a really shocking place to visit. Even in those days, although they'd been rescued about four weeks before, they still looked like skeletons and could hardly speak and in a terrible state. I may say the hospital, Glyn Hughes Hospital, after the first British senior doctor who opened it, must have done wonders there. But there was this language barrier because they came from all over Europe, really. I mean, Romania and Russia and the lot. As a matter of interest, Marlene Dietrich, who you may have heard about, visited the camp at one stage and called in on our Officer Smith. And we gave her a drink and had a social evening with her, which was rather a nice change from what normally happens there.